It is that time of year where the people we elected to the state legislature set about the business of adopting the rules that we must live by. Among some of the changes that are being proposed, restoring felons' right to vote and calling for a constitutional convention. Those proposals in particular come from a certain East Side Democratic state lawmaker, and Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has the details.
Election reform is one of the top priorities for 48th District State Senator Patty Cooterer, who has pre-filed several bills to address the issue ahead of the start of the legislative session next week. Among the proposals, restoring the voting rights of felons on parole, a practice she says goes back to Jim Crow laws.
So this has its genesis in discrimination. I'm a former prosecutor, and I just don't see the logical connection between losing your right to vote and incarceration. I definitely see having to lose your right to liberty when you commit a crime. But when you're out on parole, that means that you've served your sentence, you're on the back end of it. And I just don't see why those people who were trying to get to be reentered into community as productive members, that we deny them the opportunity to participate.
And then there's this proposal.
To call for a constitutional convention of the states to overturn Citizens United, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that essentially opened the floodgates for unlimited amounts of money to get into campaigns. And we're not seeing any action being taken on that at the federal level. And there are other states that have passed this joint memorial. And when you get to a critical mass, then there has to be a constitutional convention for the sole purpose of overturning Citizens United.
At least 16 states have already done this. And Cooterer says it's a numbers game, that once enough of them do it and get close to that magic number of the 2/3 of states required to mandate a constitutional convention, it's likely to prompt Congress to finally act on its own. And if not, she says, states will get the power to do so should enough pass similar legislation. She also takes direct aim at President Trump with a bill that would require presidential candidates to release their tax returns before the primary.
Well, he is the only candidate not to do that, isn't he? Even though he promised that he was going to release his tax returns while he was running. So on that promise, there may have been people who voted for him. But I think, you know, when you're dealing with the president of the United States, I think it is important information for us to have to see whether or not there's any, you know, outside foreign influence over him, and certainly his tax returns, given his business dealings around the country, especially over in Russia, would tell us that.
Under Cooterer's proposal, presidential candidates that don't release their tax returns prior to the primary won't be allowed to be on our primary ballot.
And Hannah joins us now. The tax returns thing, is that allowed? Can you set conditions like that for putting somebody on the ballot in Washington State?
And she seemed to think so, and she was a lawyer. She did, though, have one qualifier. She said that there is some chatter on Capitol Hill that the House may do something like this on its own, so she may wait to see how that plays out. But well, symbolic or not, she's got this down pre-filed in the hopper in Olympia, and we'll see how it plays out.
And on setting up this nationwide constitutional convention, which would be the first since 1787, I believe.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
How many states would have to go along for that to happen?
34 states, and to clarify what I said there in the report, 16 have done so, but 16 states have already passed constitutional amendment resolutions, which are non-binding. Only 3 have done what she's proposing here, which is to call for this constitutional convention. So we'd have quite a ways to go. I'm not sure if any more states are proposing it this upcoming legislative session besides ours. But again, her overall goal here is to put the pressure on. She says historically, when states have passed things like this, they have prompted Congress to take some action on its own. But she's hoping that there'll be some pressure and get more states on. Then if Congress doesn't act, then states can do so on their own. It would be kind of a historic day.
Right. Well, I understand that the whole idea is to exert pressure so that the Congress would be incentivized to pass a constitutional amendment on its own. But if it were to get to the constitutional convention part, my understanding is, one of the reasons this is so scary to a lot of people, is what's to say that they would limit that convention to simply overturning Citizens United? Wouldn't it throw the whole Constitution open to changes of any kind, which could mean, of concern to conservatives, getting rid of the Second Amendment, and of concern to liberals, putting limits on the First Amendment? I mean, what's the guarantee?
Well, the guarantee in our state legislation that she's proposing is that it's limited. It's simply limited.
So that's written into the convention, yes. Then, if it were to convene, would have that in writing that this is for simply one purpose, Citizens United and nothing else.
Yeah, under Patty Cooterer's bill. I'm not sure what the other three states that have passed this already, what theirs say, but I imagine it would be along the same lines. Something I would look into, though.
Kai Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Online Trading Academy, now just 3 days before the Alaskan Way Viaduct closes for eternity. And listeners are hitting us up on their commutes and what they can do to get around it. Today, Chris is talking about light rail and sounder service.
Yeah, listener Vicky texted me last week asking if Sound Transit was going to add trains or extra train cars to help move more people during the closure. Another listener, Julianne, asked me if freight train schedules were going to change. I'll have an answer on that one shortly, but I'm going to start first with Sound Transit and what you can expect during the closure. Agency spokesperson Kimberly Reason told me that there aren't any plans to add service during the closure. The light rail trains will continue to run every 6 minutes during peak commute hours and every 10 minutes the rest of the day, but Sound Transit is maxing out their capacity.
We're rolling out as many three-car trains as we can, and we are also keeping an extra train, what we call in the business a gap train, ready to be deployed at a moment's notice when needed anywhere in the system.
So why isn't Sound Transit adding any cars? Well, they don't have any. I mean, they're using all the ones they have available. All the new light rail train cars that have been ordered will not be delivered until later this year. Now, if you're a regular rider, you should be expecting a lot of new company.
Well, give yourself more time, certainly, whether it's by bus or train, because even if it's by train, it's possible that the train might be full by the time it gets to your station, in which case you might need to wait for the next train.
Now, for South End drivers, I've been recommending that you drive in and try to catch light rail, say at Angle Lake or Tukwila. Say you're driving in from Federal Way, drive half the way there. But a listener tried that on Monday, and the Angle Lake lot was full. So if you plan to try this, you need to get there early, maybe before 7 a.m., maybe even earlier than that, to get one of the parking spots there. Now, if you're thinking about trying Sounder during the closure, go to MyNorthwest.com to find Sound Transit's ridership guide to see which trains usually have space.
We have a graphic up for Sounder that shows by train about how many seats are generally available during the non-closure times. And that can help people gauge, well, it looks like they might have some space on this train.
So if your alternate plans include trying light rail or sounder, please don't wait until next Monday to try it. Make sure you research how to pay, how to use the system, and maybe give it a dry run this week. Reason says the agency itself is also going to be as flexible as possible.
Our operations team will be monitoring train capacity and conditions and bus closely throughout the entire closure, and will determine service levels as needed.
As for the freight train question, moving their schedules to help out, well, good luck with that one. Listener Julianne says she's often stuck on Spokane Street waiting for trains, and we all know through SoDo is going to be a bear through the next couple of weeks. Well, those freight train schedules are not going to change. Now, I did reach out to BNSF, and it said it has schedules to keep, but it's aware of the closure and will attempt to not block crossings for extended periods of time. So if we're not going to get any love from freight, they can't really change their schedules. So good luck there through SoDo across those crossings.
I'm already seeing more car traffic during my 4:30 commute.
Yeah, you are. I'm seeing a lot. The commute started yesterday and today about an hour earlier than I've seen going into this. So I think people are trying that early commute. They may come to find out that they may have to get up even earlier to try to beat everybody else in.
Every January, the longing eyes of tech lovers turn to Las Vegas, where they see obscenely large televisions, artificially affectionate robots, and, of course, snazzy new high-tech cars at the Consumer Electronics Show. And automotive reporter and broadcast legend Jeff Gilbert from WWJ is in Las Vegas. He joins us live. Are there any flying cars there this year?
No, but, you know, it's kind of funny. Looking at some of the media here, you don't see your typical media that you see at an auto show. And I was at a presentation yesterday where somebody asked a question and she identified herself as being from Flying Car Daily. So I need to subscribe to that, whatever it is.
Flying Car Daily. So the question stands, are there cars with wings out there or hover cars or what?
Yeah, you know, there might be. Today is the actual day that the exhibits open. I've been in presentations the last couple of days, and most of what they've been talking about is autonomy, self-driving cars, and it seems to be there are two camps. One camp says self-driving cars are just around the corner. We got to get used to it. Another camp led by Toyota is saying, well, you know, we can't really tell you when self-driving cars are coming, so we think it's better to put in safety systems that prevent crashes and let the self-driving cars develop themselves.
Yeah. You took a drive in a self-driving Lyft car?
I did. Do you say take a drive or take a ride?
Take a ride.
I was in the back seat. Yeah, they've been using this as part of the Lyft service in Las Vegas for a year. They say they've gotten a 4.95 rating, so I guess there are a few people who are dissatisfied. You can't please everybody, but they still have a safety driver in that vehicle, but they say next year they'll have a new one that won't have a safety driver, so that could get interesting.
Okay, so you were not alone in the car then. You still had a safety driver there.
Oh, come on. I'm in the media. They would never leave me alone in the car. They wouldn't even let me talk to the safety driver. I had to talk to the executive from Aptiv, the auto supplier that was doing it.
Well, I mean, so it drove downtown successfully without the guy having to touch the steering wheel?
Yeah, he only touched the steering wheel once. He ran into construction, and they said that was out of an abundance of caution, that the vehicle could have handled it, but he's supposed to take over in those cases. And the other thing is they make the safety drivers drive when they pull up to the casinos, because I don't think self-driving cars yet have external breathalyzers, and I don't think they've determined how to deal with drunks yet. But seriously, I said that as a joke, but when they fully automate, they're going to have special drop-off and pickup points because they are concerned about drunks stepping out in front of them.
Well, sure. Well, it's kind of self-defeating, though, because if you need a driver for any part of the ride, you need the driver for the entire ride. So how would that save any money?
Well, the idea right now is that this is a pilot program. They're going to build on it, and eventually they won't need a driver. But right now, it's not saving money. And, you actually bring up a good point, because the car industry is talking now about robo-taxis and things like that, which would save money without drivers. But the government regulators are talking about saving lives, and most of that would be on high-speed highways, urban roads, things of that nature. And nobody has cracked that code yet where you can get into a self-driving vehicle and take it wherever you want to go, whenever you want to go.
Okay, so let's talk about the technology that's going to be available, like, next year. I drove a rental car recently which had those proximity detectors in the rearview mirrors that warn you when you're about to change lanes and crash into a car. I found that to be tremendously helpful. Is there more stuff like that coming?
Yeah, that kind of stuff has actually been in cars a couple of years. You're talking about things like blind spot detection, lane departure warning. We're going to start seeing that in just about every car. What's really interesting is next year, Toyota wants to launch something that it's tentatively calling Guardian, which takes all of these technologies and uses artificial intelligence really to figure out whether or not you're able to handle a situation. And it would take over when you can't handle the situation.
Wow.
You know, a bad ice, imminent crash, things of that nature.
Wow.
So that'll be interesting. And they actually say they're so excited about the technology that they're willing to sell it to other car companies if they want to bundle it in their vehicles.
So it's called Guardian. So in other words, the fundamental premise is that you are the driver. You are in control of the car. But if the artificial intelligence senses that you're about to make us screw things up, it just takes over.
Exactly. Yeah. Think of Guardian as shorthand for guardian angel looking over you. That's the idea. And that's the in-house name. They haven't decided yet what they're going to call it publicly, how they're going to market it.
And Harley Davidson is going to sell electric motorcycles? Do you mean that they would actually sell a quiet motorcycle?
Yeah, you know, I interviewed the Harley person. I didn't get a chance to hear what it sounds like. I'm assuming it has that electric whir, and there will be a Harley whir to go along with the Harley roar. But seriously, I mean, those of us who grew up in the baby boom era have one image of Harley. Younger people, I mean, it's not even on their radar. So they're trying to get on the radar of young urban professionals. And they think something electric with about 110-mile range might be something that's popular with younger people, kind of as an entry-level Harley, and it's also connected. So, hey, you can tweet just before you wipe out.
I bet. I bet they include an artificial roar sound effect for those who want one. That's great. Thank you, Jeff.
Yep, the electronic version of putting baseball cards in the spokes of your bicycle.
That's exactly right, except completely deafening. Jeff Gilbert from WWJ live in Las Vegas at CES. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's talk housing prices with Matthew Gardner, chief economist for Windermere Real Estate. And the story is, and we'll get to the new multiple listing report in just a moment here, which you've got in front of you. But the story's been that rental prices and house prices are softening in the area, which I think would be good news. Is it?
Yes, it is. There are two different parts here, and certainly on the rental component, some softening there is mainly a function of oversupply. We've delivered an awful lot of new apartment units over the course of the last 4 or 5 years. There's only so much demand for them. And so when you see supply exceeding demand, you're going to see some softening. And some numbers I've heard that, was it 1 in 10 apartment units is currently vacant?
Yes.
That seems to be a fairly massive number.
It does.
We'll see how accurate that is. But it doesn't surprise me. When you bring on a lot of supply, you're going to see some softening not only in rental rates, but also you're going to see some vacancies rise as well. So the apartment market, again, I think is going to see stability next year, but it's going to take a bit of time to get there.
So for your modest 2-bedroom working class apartment, what would you expect to pay in Seattle?
In South Lake Union, about $3,200 a month.
Yikes.
It's a lot of money.
That's called softening?
Yeah, exactly. Those are the asking rates. I mean, again, that's very specific to where it is. But if you look at the greater Seattle area, your 2-bedroom unit, you're probably going to be in that $2,400 to $2,600.
I saw that Bellevue's even more expensive, though.
It is. I mean, we're starting to see, the evolution of Bellevue has been quite remarkable. I mean, we're seeing, obviously, an awful lot of new commercial activity there. New apartment units being built, new office space. Obviously, Amazon moving into that marketplace is going to be a very major impact as well. So that's going to have effects, and that's going to push rental rates in Bellevue up, I believe.
Mm-hmm. But we no longer are seeing people bidding over the asking price for homes?
Okay, we're moving from apartments to ownership. Yeah, I mean, that certainly has been the case. We are not in a buyer's market yet. However, we're heading towards a more stabilized market and a market balance. But I think what we saw over the course of the last couple of years, we're seeing, if a home came on the market on a Sunday and there were 25 offers by the Wednesday, that has certainly gone away. And the main reason why is we've seen a big influx of new supply, new numbers of homes coming on the market. That started really about September, October time. Big spike. The big question is, why is this? I think a lot of people were really kind of hedged the market. They saw mortgage rates rise. They believed the market would be peaking, therefore a good time to sell. So we saw a lot of new supply. When you start seeing new supply, that means the demand is going to be pulled back a little bit. And so a lot of home buyers are now just saying, perhaps we're just going to wait. Perhaps there'll be more choice next year. Perhaps prices will continue to soften. If that's the case, then that kind of really explains the fact why we're seeing pending sales start to drop and overall total closed sales drop. That will change, I think, in the spring as we move forward. But are we heading towards a more balanced market? Yes. Is it a buyer's market? No, it's not.
So looking at the new multiple listings report, what are the headlines there?
I think the biggest headline, certainly for King County, is the fact that home prices year over year in King County only rose by 2%. So that is a very, very low figure, and as low as we've seen it in several years. So I think that really is, again, and some people will actually argue, are we seeing a price correction? Are we going to see house prices continue to drop? I would argue, no, that's not the case. Why do I say that? Well, quite simply, I think we've reached an affordability ceiling. Now, in concert with the fact of the last several months, as I mentioned, mortgage rates rose by over 0.5%. That impacts people's buying power substantially. That means you're going to see some softening, new supply. Also explains the fact you're going to see home price growth slow. But are we going to see a major contraction or anything like that we saw back in 2009, 2010? I just don't see that happening. But I think what's going to have to happen is we'll see essentially home prices remain roughly where they are. They'll trend up higher probably in the spring, but at far more modest rates. Also, you have to allow incomes to rise. And we're certainly seeing very significant income growth in Seattle. That's a positive, which will offset mortgage rates if they start rising again next year, which I believe that they will.
Now, we've talked before about what the long-term solution is, and part of it is changing the zoning, and you're certainly seeing some flexibility now from the city council on doing that, right? Is there, do you see enough of the city being opened up to apartment buildings to make a long-term difference in the housing price?
Well, I think we talk less about apartments, more about ownership
right.
housing.
I conflate the two, because they are related. I mean, we're talking about...
I mean, they're to a degree fungible, so yeah, that's correct. But if you so when we talk about ownership housing, yes. Are they making steps? Yes, they are. However, are they going as far as Minneapolis did, which basically in the last couple of months, they eviscerated single-family zoning throughout the entire city.
Really?
They just got rid of it. So I think that's going to be an interesting thing, which I will be watching very closely to see what effect that has. We clearly have not gone that far in Seattle. We're open up to ideas. However, 70% of the city is still zoned single-family. That might have made sense in the 1950s. It does not make sense now. So we need to try and address this. And I think certain steps are being made. It's a very long and very arduous process, because you're still going to find people who are going to turn around and say, you know, it's going to be carte blanche for the developers. They can build anything, anywhere, with no controls. And that's absolutely not the case. You've still got design review. You've still got permitting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think developers are motivated to make a mess of the city, because then people are not going to be attracted to their product.
That is right. However, they might not be doing that. However, people that live in the neighborhoods fear that that is going to be the case.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Of course, developers won't do that, but it's the mentality of current owners. I mean, we like to embrace housing for everyone. That's a great thing. However, we don't want it built next door to us. We want it built somewhere else.
Yeah. Are people still having to write essentially love letters to their prospective landlords to get in?
Right. No. I mean, thankfully, we certainly saw a lot of that last year. The, the groveling letters from the home buyer saying, please choose me. In fact, the funniest one I ever read was a letter not from a would-be buyer. It was from their dog. Like, I love your yard. Please let my owners buy your house. Those have gone away. Again, it's as we move to balance, I think it makes more sense. But I think as important as anything else, it's not looking too myopically at the numbers. Housing is not a stock. It's a home first and an asset second. That is certainly my opinion. So if you worry too much over month changes, you're never going to sleep again. And so the long-term trend in King County, home prices on average for the last 20 years have risen by about 5.5% annually. We're trending down to that number. That's roughly where I expect it to be in 2019, year over year. That's certainly a very solid number, and certainly far higher than the national average. But you're going to see some variations over the course of months, and some contractions and some increase as well. But don't worry about it. Home prices are not collapsing.
Matthew Gardner, Chief Economist, Windermere Real Estate. Matthew, thank you.
Always welcome.
Your daily dose of kindness now. For those who park their car on the streets of Ashland, Oregon, they may find a surprise letter under their windshield wiper or tucked in their car door. That would be the work of Kokei Nosakir.
I wanted to do something that I thought was practical, would have some impact. So what came to mind is writing a letter, and a handwritten letter, because we're so digital, we're so social media orientated.
KTVL says he likes to spread kindness by writing letters and leaving them around the community.
Dear beloved, thank you for choosing to receive this handwritten expression of love.
He thinks he's written more than 4,000 letters so far, wants to reach 5,000.
What I've learned is they are best received when they are found on their own. So you might find some inside of the little libraries, car doors, bulletin boards, bathroom stalls. Most people say that it brightened their day, it caused some sunshine to come in.
And on that note, I want to thank a listener for her handwritten note. I just received it yesterday. It's very rare to get a letter in the mail these days. It's from Patty Hill. Thank you, Patty. She said, Dear Colleen, I don't remember saying this, but she says, I heard you say a couple of weeks ago that thank you notes are hard to write. They're really not. I want to thank you for, and she's going to goes on and on, nice, says very nice things about me. It sounds self-serving if I read it on air.
I'll read it for you.
She also really loves it when we gently spar, Dave. I didn't know that we gently sparred, but that's good. And she, the dose of kindness makes her day. Well, Patty, you made my day.
That's nice.
Thank you. No.
Does gently sparring include kicking under the desk?
Yeah, seriously. I got a shock collar on Dave.
Your radio presence is great fun to listen to. Look at that. And you are thoughtful, articulate, and smart. a role model needed for all women. Oh, wow.
What pressure.
Holy cow. Now you got to write a book.
I know. He's talking about how brightness and sunshine comes in when you write somebody a note.
Yeah, you're all blushing now.
I know I am. But thank you, Patty.
Time for a Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And now here he is, that invincible tiger of sports, Danny O'Neill. Wow. What happened to Alabama?
They got rolled up into a carpet and dumped into the river, as Deadspin put it, which I thought was pretty awesome. It was fantastic. The bully got put into a headlock and wailed on unmercifully.
And the winning quarterback is that freshman with the flowing wavy hair?
Trevor Lawrence.
Trevor Lawrence, yeah.
Yeah. He looks like sunshine.
He looks like Samson.
Yeah. You think that? You think he's got his strength in his hair?
He is one of the more unusual-looking quarterbacks, I'll say that.
No kidding. How so?
Don't you think so?
Maybe. I don't know. He's
really
got long
tall,
hair.
Really tall torso
what was his
and
name
long
again?
Arms.
Trevor Lawrence. Trevor Lawrence. He replaced another guy named Kelly Bryant, which I thought was weird, that apparently it's a requirement at Clemson that if you're going to be the quarterback, you have two first names.
So is he going to be a star? I mean, it looks like
certainly it. Looks like it. It certainly looks like. And this would be the interesting thing of if there was no age limit in the NFL, you would have people talking right now of, like, is he going to enter the draft? Because it's a relatively quarterback-poor draft where Dwayne Haskins from Ohio State is considered the top overall pick, and I don't think he's that good.
I know you've said that it's very tough to compare, like you know, how Jake Locker would do in the pros. And so with this guy, though, do you see potential for someone like that?
He's huge, and it looks like he has an incredibly strong arm. Those would be the two things that I think you can pretty... Yeah. And the way he stood up to an Alabama defense that has generally trounced opposing quarterbacks, look no further than what happened to Jake Browning 2 years ago when the Huskies played Alabama. I don't think this Alabama defense is quite as good as that defense was 2 years ago, but it's still an Alabama defense, and you probably got six or seven NFL players, six or seven guys that are going to get drafted who are on that defense right now. It's pretty impressive what he was able to do, and he's got all the size and all the strength that any NFL team would want. Now, he's going to have to play two more years of college football before he's even eligible to consider going to the NFL. But if there wasn't an age limit, I think you'd hear a lot of talk right now about would he go to the NFL right now.
Sully, you had a question about
that. Well, no, I was just going to talk about it. I mean, a couple of things from that game, Danny. I've never seen Alabama look so discombobulated, not prepared for what they were seeing. And then also, you talk about Trevor Lawrence. Their leading receiver, who is making ridiculous catches, is also another true freshman. They're loaded.
Yeah, from Alabama.
No, from Clemson
kid,
too.
The kid,
yeah,
Justin,
from Alabama, but
Justin
he went to
Ross
Clemson. Yeah,
is from the state of Alabama. Went to Clemson and he destroyed him last night. He had maybe the most impressive, outside of Odell Beckham Jr. catching a ball with three fingers, maybe the most impressive one-handed catch I've ever seen, where he was reaching back. It wasn't with his body. He was reaching back against it and was able to corral. It was incredible. Clemson is loaded. And Nick Saban looked like a guy. Now, Nick
is the Alabama coach.
Yes, is considered, he's sort of the Armani coach. He's very particular about things. The Nick-tator is his nickname because he's not considered to be the most, he's an authoritarian. He does not run a democracy. That was usually when they lose, he starts screaming at people. And he couldn't even get worked up to yell at anybody last night. And I don't know whether it's because he's going to be moving on to greener pastures, a.k.a. the NFL, or if he really just knew that they were going to get whooped. And so he took it on the chin and decided not to complain. But he was very, very placid.
And that's completely opposite from Pete Carroll's style, right? He's always looking positive, always thinking positive. What did he have to say after Saturday's loss? He was on with you guys yesterday.
Yeah, Pete talked a lot about the optimism for the future and how much they'd accomplished.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, and look, that this is just the beginning and we're just getting going. He and Russell, that's pretty much the script that they always recite.
And he talked a little bit about Russell's contract, too.
Yeah, Russell has 1 year left on his contract after this. It's going to be a priority for them to extend it. I think that's going to be a difficult negotiation. I think that Russell's going to look for the most money that a quarterback's ever gotten. And I think there are a couple different contracts that have complicated the scenario for what he'll get. The reality, though, is that Russell isn't going anywhere. Even if he weren't to sign a new contract, he's not leaving for next season. He wouldn't be leaving the season after that. Probably not even the season after that. You're going to look at it's a very complicated process. If he were to actually try to get to unrestricted free agency, I don't see that.
He's one of those franchise players.
He
right?
would be. If he's out of contract, he would have a franchise tag applied to him. So while there's going to be a lot of discussion about it, and we're going to be doing it, and I don't see that being resolved before August. I think it'll be a lot of talk up until then.
Is he already highest paid?
He's the highest paid player on the team, but he'll look to be the highest paid quarterback.
So how much, what does that figure look like?
Well, and that's where the specifics, he's going to want $30 million, and he's going to want the $30 million, the entire content of it guaranteed. Kirk Cousins, who signed with Minnesota in the offseason, signed a three-year contract at about $30 million with the full content guaranteed. So he's going to look at
that. So $30 million for all 3 years?
$30 million per year.
Per year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does he have the leverage?
Yeah. He's certainly a better quarterback than Kirk Cousins is. The question, does he have the leverage? He's not going to be an unrestricted free agent, so no, he doesn't. Mm-hmm. Kirk Cousins had to play on a series of one-year contracts to get to the point where he was then able to leverage the $30 million fully guaranteed. So we'll see how that goes.
So by the time the Russell Wilson era is over, Trevor Lawrence is available and we could get him.
That's correct. However, given how big Trevor Lawrence is and how good he looks, you're going to have to stink the year before you draft him because you're going to have to be the worst team in the league to have that draft pick. You ready for Tankapalooza? Do you want to tank?
I don't want to have the Mariners and the Seahawks tank.
I know, that'd be terrible. But maybe by the time Trevor Lawrence is eligible, the Mariners will be good.
Yeah. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Sports Insider brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. We are entering day 18 of the partial government shutdown. Tonight at 6 o'clock, the president makes his case to the public with an Oval Office address. It will get a response from the Democrats. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, let's go to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold about the breaking news this morning, which is that Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, who was at the famous, or I guess notorious now, Trump Tower meeting, has been charged with obstruction of justice. And what's interesting to me, David, is this is in connection with a tax fraud case where Russian criminal organizations were filing for phony tax refunds from the IRS using the names of real companies. I know this is completely different from the Mueller investigation, but when I hear somebody that has a connection between Trump and tax fraud, I wonder if, once again, this is something that would be revealed by releasing those tax returns.
Yeah, I wonder that myself. As you said, this is not related to the Trump Tower meeting, but this context of this other case does underscore a couple of things that are important when we think about the Trump Tower meeting. One, as you said, this is a case that involves Russian organized crime, and the accusations here show that Veselnitskaya allegedly coordinated with the senior prosecutor within Russia's government to mislead the U.S. government. So we're showing deep ties between this woman and the Russian government and the Russian mob. So when you think about who Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner were meeting in Trump Tower that day, you know, when you say a Russian lawyer, this is the kind of lawyer we're talking about, somebody who's deeply connected to a lot of bad stuff in Russia.
Right. Does this justify, then, somebody subpoenaing the president's tax returns?
I don't think this, you know, on top of everything else that we know about the president's tax returns, I don't think this adds much to the case. The case is very strong without this, but I do want to see where this goes. There's no indication, I think, from the case that she's charged in that the Trump organization was involved in that at all.
Okay. We do beat up on Trump a lot in these segments, David. I think even you will acknowledge that. So I wanted to bring up this extraordinary fact check on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Your own paper gave her four Pinocchios for fudging some information. So let's go over that. What did she say?
Well, the interesting thing was how she defended it. I thought that she talked about saying, well, you know, I got the facts wrong, but I felt, you know, that the error came from my feelings. You know, and it sort of, she seemed to give the, not in the same words, but in the context of sort of, it sounded like what President Trump and Kellyanne Conway have said, you know, this is alternative facts, that if I feel strongly enough a certain way, the facts will bend in my direction. And it's not true for her, it's not true for Trump either.
So she said something about her statement involved exaggerating Pentagon waste, I believe it was.
I think that's right. So, and she was unhappy about it in the end. She sort of, you know, our fact checker said, look, this, you know, the same facts apply to everybody. You're not, what's that old saying? You're entitled to your own opinion, but not to your own facts. She seems to have been a little more contrite about it since then, and said, you know, I'm, you know, being a fact checker, you know, being fact checked makes me better. So, you know, there's hope, I guess. But, it was surprising to see this person who's like a, you know, a rising star in the Democratic Party seeming to use her own feelings to justify her own facts.
How did fellow Democrats react to this? I from what I read on Twitter, there were some saying, look, just because because you don't like Trump doesn't mean you should adopt his approach to facts.
Yes, and people, I mean, to be honest, there's been much more reaction among, you know, inter-Democratic reaction to another freshman, Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, using an expletive that, you know, she said about Trump, we're going to impeach that blankety-blank. There's been much more reaction against her than there has been against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But people have, I think, chided her. There's so much going on that no news lasts for more than 5 minutes, and that's, you know, that's a factor of the Trump era, whether you're Trump or somebody else.
Okay, the address tonight, the vice president doesn't seem to know exactly what the president's going to say. He was asked about, I mean, usually it's his job to, you know, warm us up for what's coming. But the big question was, is he going to declare a national emergency because of the border? What do you know about that?
Well, we had a good story in today's paper saying, what you were referring to, that Kristen Nielsen, the Homeland Security Secretary, and Pence had a public briefing yesterday when they tried to sort of, they used the word emergency a lot, seemingly trying to lay the political and maybe legal groundwork for the president declaring an emergency tonight. I think we've seen a lot of evidence, though, that, you know, the law that Trump is thinking about using is not designed for this. It's designed for, you know, what is an emergency? It's something that emerges, a new factor that Congress doesn't have time to process. The president has to act on his own. That's certainly not the case here. The border crisis, which Trump is calling it, has existed in basically the same form for 2 years, and there's nothing that's new about right now that means that he can't wait for Congress to act. Anyway, the numbers of border apprehensions, the actual traffic on the border, are down to the levels from the 1970s, are far below where they were under Obama. So even if you compare it to recent history, there's not really a strong case for now being something so different and new that Trump has to act. But nevertheless, they said the word emergency a lot, and I think that's going to be if Trump chooses to use that path, that's going to be their approach.
And this gets us back to exaggerating facts. Now, the vice president's been taken to task by a number of sources for citing a statistic that, what do you say, 17,000 apprehensions of criminals at the border?
I think the statistic I saw was 4,000 apprehensions of people who were suspected of being terrorists. So, you know, that gets blown up to say there were 4,000 terrorists arrested on the border. As you know, something Trump and a lot of other Republicans have talked about is the idea that terrorists could be infiltrating the country by walking over the southern border. When pressed on that figure, the Department of Homeland Security revised it down from 4,000 to 6. Not 6,000, 6 possible people who might have been on a terrorist watch list. It's just not how any terrorists have ever come to this country. They can come in through the airports if they want to. So that statistic people have been leaning on so heavily, I think Sarah Huckabee Sanders said it, it's just not true at all.
All right, so if he declares an emergency, what would that mean? What would that allow him to do?
I think in this context, there's a specific law that he's citing that gives the president emergency powers to shift around money within the Pentagon. As you know, money in the Pentagon is, you know, it's not just a giant pile of money that the president can spend however he wants. Money is earmarked for certain activities within the Pentagon, and there's no money for building a giant wall. $5 billion is what Trump says it'll cost. So this would enable Trump to say, well, I declare an emergency, so I'm going to shift money from other things the Pentagon has to pay for, you know, all the military, the Army Corps of Engineers build the wall. That doesn't seem... That would give, for Trump, that's a short-term political benefit because it would allow him to get out of this shutdown that is making him look bad and hurting people around the country. He could say, well, forget it, Democrats. I don't need you to fund my wall. I'll fund my wall with emergency funding from the Pentagon. Then they could reopen the government. If that is the path he takes, it's likely to be a court challenge, and I think people think it'll take a long time to be resolved. Certainly, there'll be no wall built right away because it'll be put on hold pending a court challenge.
Well, I saw some people trying to argue that this would be illegal, but the way you put it, if it's the Army Corps of Engineers building a project, the Army Corps of Engineers is building stuff all the time. Why would it be illegal to build a wall?
I think it's because the Corps of Engineers had not, you know, they don't have money for building the wall. There's no money within the Pentagon to build the giant wall. There's money to build other things, but you can't just shift money from one project to the other. And that's what, I guess that's the idea. The declaration of an emergency would enable the president to shift that money around. You know, it seems likely to be a face-saving way for Trump to end the shutdown and then blame somebody else when the wall doesn't get built. They'll blame the courts or the Democrats when the wall doesn't get built, rather than having to take the blame himself for backing down and not building the wall.
I see. All right, so tonight the president has an address. 6 o'clock, we'll carry it live here, and it's going to be followed by a Democratic response, which usually happens after a State of the Union address. But Chuck and Nancy are saying, essentially, since the president is bound to lie during his address, we have to correct him. This is the first time I can remember that argument being made.
This is a weird presidential address, though. I mean, most of the time the presidents address the nation, they address the nation about things that are not inherently political in nature. They're not making up, using that sort of special power the president has to call the nation's attention to himself. The presidents aren't usually using that to make a political statement. The last president, Obama, did this in 2014. He made a statement about immigration. The networks decided it was political, and almost nobody cared. I think the cable TV news networks cared it, but the major networks didn't. Trump, in this case, is saying, well, you know, he's making a statement about his position in an ongoing policy fight. I think the networks have decided, well, do we take that? Is it just political? Is it, you know, is this something where we're giving the president a platform to make a political statement, not speaking as the president? Maybe this is how they're going to compromise this, by showing Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi responding to it.
All right. David Farenthold from The Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you.